The first three episodes of the Top 11 Themes of Jesus podcast happen to have aligned themes talking about evil, judgment, and eternal life. In this episode, number 8, as we count down toward number 1, Jesus is talking about a different kind of battle than good versus evil. He's discussing the spiritual versus the material. Hello, everybody. I'm Cecil Taylor with Cecil Taylor Ministries, and you're listening to podcast season 3, The Top 11 Themes of Jesus. Please check out my other podcasts, as always, and of course, I encourage comments. As a quick introduction for those of you hearing this podcast season for the first time, I analyzed the Gospels and counted the number of times Jesus talked about different topics. I grouped the topics into a number of themes. 11 of them stood out above others as being the most discussed. In this podcast series, I am sharing with you the top 11 themes of Jesus, counting down toward number 1 next March. In the Gospels, Jesus was very clear that God's will, not possessions or temporary situations, should come first in one's life. His disciples are to prioritize and focus on the spiritual life rather than on the material life. I'll also share three sub-themes under this main theme. We are to make God the most important thing in our lives. We are supposed to guard against prioritizing the praise of humans. And we are supposed to be wary of materialism and temporary things. That's where I want to start, is with that sub-theme, warning about materialism and the temporary. After I explore those three sub-themes, I will be joined on the podcast by John Rabins, author of the award-winning book, Defined by Fire, Seven Life-Changing Lessons from Devastating Tragedy. John wrote this book in response to an incredibly tragic time 10 years ago, when he lost his home and possessions to fire and his father to death on the same day. This episode set John on a journey to understanding even more clearly than before that the spiritual is greater than the material. I'll talk to John about his experience and elements of it that relate to our podcast theme, and I can promise you there's a lot of gold that came out of his experience. I should mention that one of the interesting things about the scripture under theme number 8 is the number of different analogies and situations that Jesus recites in order to make his points of the spiritual over the material. So let's sample some wide-ranging scripture and learn what Jesus said. One of Jesus' clearest descriptions of prioritizing the spiritual over the material came in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, verses 19 through 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now that's a classic verse. Perhaps you've heard that before, and it describes one of the truest statements about life. Things change. We can try to hold everything together, but rust and fire and critters and thieves and atmospheric conditions and more have a way of changing the material items we prize. And even if they do somehow last, you can't take them with you. So Jesus pivots our attention to the things of heaven and eternity rather than the things of this world. This same thought is expressed in a different way in the parable of the rich fool and his barns from Luke 12, verses 13 through 21. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." Jesus starts by warning against prizing the abundance of possessions, then tells the ultimate story of you can't take it with you. Again, we see the temporary nature of wealth and health. I love the line that we need to be rich toward God instead of storing up things for ourselves. This implies a selfishness and a stinginess that we might have, spending our money on ourselves and not being charitable towards God's causes. Both of these passages have dealt with riches, but Jesus also pointed out some subtle ways in which we prioritize the material over the spiritual. In John 6, verses 25 through 27, Jesus has just performed the miracle of feeding the 5,000, and many people who were present have caught up to him on the opposite side of the Sea of Galilee. Let's read. When they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, "Rabbi, when did you get here?" Jesus answered, "Very truly I tell you, you are looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. Do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him God the Father has placed his seal of approval." Now we'll hear a passage later that is a cousin to this one, but falls under a different sub-theme. But you hear the message, you're looking for the wrong kind of food right now. You need to look for God's food that endures. Another way we might prioritize the material over the spiritual is in our activities and use of time. Jesus told the parable of the wedding feast in Matthew 22, 1-10, to illustrate this point. Jesus spoke to them again in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused to come. Then he sent some more servants and said, 'Tell those who have been invited that I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fattened cattle have been butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet.' But they paid no attention and went off, one to his field, another to his business. The rest seized his servants, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. Then he said to his servants, 'The wedding banquet is ready, but those who I invited did not deserve to come. So go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone you find.' So the servants went out into the streets and gathered all the people they could find, the bad as well as the good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests." Now, admittedly, Jesus is talking about more than one thing in this parable. And by the way, as I mentioned in the first episode, the number 11 theme, it's also common for Jesus to have multiple themes going on in one passage. That is the case here because he is also criticizing the Jewish leaders who have not accepted him as the Messiah. And so Jesus' message is taken up more by the common people. But the actual descriptions in the parable also show people more concerned with their own affairs than with the things of God. Well, it's almost fall when Sunday school classes and small groups get back into full swing, and to help your planning, I'm offering a free trial of my book and video studies with a sample one-week video lesson. I took one page out of my first book, The Next Thing, and expanded it into a one-week video lesson for small groups. The title is Live the Life That Is Given. It tells the story of a 13-year-old girl who died of cystic fibrosis. After her passing, her mother found this phrase written in her diary, "I will live the life that is given." I expand on that phrase in the video, and it leads to insightful, poignant discussion in group settings. You can go to my website to access this video lesson through streaming or download. There is also a downloadable leader guide and even a message guide if your pastor wants to integrate the video with a sermon. I've included the link in the text below your podcast player, but you can also visit my homepage, ceciltaylorministries.com, to find the link. Just go to the More part on the top ribbon and drop that down, and then you will see the resources for Live the Life That Is Given. Please, give it a try. As we continue now to review Jesus' sayings about focusing on the spiritual and not the material, we come to the second sub-theme of making God the most important thing in our lives. Two of the clearest verses are in Matthew 6, part of the Sermon on the Mount. In verse 24, Jesus says, "No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." I think it's easy to interpret this verse, and if you want to substitute money with another master, that will work too. Addiction can be a master. Your ego can be your master, on and on. The next verse, verse 25, connects this thought to a discussion on worry and anxiety. Verse 25 starts with, "therefore." In other words, you cannot serve two masters, therefore, and Jesus speaks at length then about worrying about temporary things. He then concludes that section in verse 33 by making one of his classic statements about prioritizing God. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Seek first his kingdom. Seek first his righteousness. Seek God's priorities before your priorities. Seek the spiritual before the material. Jesus actually said something that indicates how dramatically he made this a priority in his own life. In John 4, 31 through 34, we see this exchange between Jesus and his disciples as they traveled through Samaria. Meanwhile, his disciples urged him, "Rabbi, eat something." But he said to them, "I have food to eat that you do not know anything about." Then his disciples said to each other, "Could someone have brought him food?" "My food," said Jesus, "is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." I can almost hear our Savior's intonation as he has to shift the focus from physical food to spiritual food. Even when considering a meal, Jesus has the Father's focus foremost in his mind. Now, one of the most interesting passages in this sub-theme of making God the most important thing shows up in the midst of Jesus' diatribe about the faults of the Pharisees after he has entered Jerusalem prior to his arrest and crucifixion. I think this is an overlooked passage. In its own way, Jesus is reminding them that God is the most important thing. Let's read Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22. "Woe to you, blind guides! You say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gold of the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gift on the altar is bound by that oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, anyone who swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it, and anyone who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it, and anyone who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it." Now, though we might not swear on something as in olden days, I think there's a point here to be made. The altar is great because of God. The temple is great because of God. Heaven is great because of God. How about the earth is great because of God? A person is great because they were created by God. How would we look at the world and everything in it differently if we realized that God is the source of all things and everything that was made, as God intended, has God's brand applied to it, if you will? You are a designer person. You have the imprint of God on you. The final subtopic of this theme on spiritual versus material speaks against our focus on winning the praise of humans. I'm just going to share one verse from Matthew 23 on this subtopic. Let me preview it with a couple of points, though. First, once again, we'll encounter passages that mix themes together, and I counted them under multiple categories. This is one of them. You'll hear a couple of different things going on as we read this beyond only winning the praise of humans. Second, we want to make sure that the vocabulary is clear. There is a word in the passage, phylactery. It is a box containing scripture verses that was worn on the forehead and arm, so it was an item that could be displayed. With that, let's read Matthew 23, the first 12 verses. "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Jesus would tell people that when they sought rewards in the form of praise and recognition, those rewards were empty because that's as far as they went. The rewards to seek are heavenly rewards. Now, that concludes our scriptural exploration of the number 8 theme to focus on the spiritual rather than the material. Before we turn to the guest segment of this podcast, I want to share with you another podcast you can listen to on which I'm a guest. It's the Hanging Out with Jesus podcast, hosted by Levita Brooks. Levita and I talk on episode 80 about my first book, The Next Thing, A Christian Model for Dealing with Crisis in Personal Life. Please find the Hanging Out with Jesus podcast on Apple and Buzzsprout. More information is in this podcast description. Now it's time to bring on my guest. Now I'd like to introduce John Ravens, the author of the book Defined by Fire, 7 Life-Changing Lessons from Devastating Tragedy. And we're going to talk about the spiritual being greater than the material. And John, thanks for joining the podcast today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So let's have, if you could do a quick overview of what the book is about. And it really stems from what I would call a historic bad day.
I would say that it was one of those days where you wonder, besides that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play? That kind of
right,
a day.
Right.
I've never experienced a day like it before or since, and I don't expect to, but on the same day, we lost our 6,000 square foot home in the Black Forest to a devastating fire. We lost another property around the corner on 11 acres, 9 buildings, some historic. One was a historical one-room church that was led by a holiness pastor back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And then on the same day, my father in California, independently of all this, died. And so it was a little much to digest.
Yeah. And of course, it's, as you say in the book, with the title, I mean, Defined by Fire. There's a lot of things that came out of that. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But I do want to ask you a question about something that struck me that I could really relate to. So at a point in time, I think you're separated from where the property is. Your wife is trying to get out dogs and possessions with the fire coming down towards the property. And you're trying to get to California and where your father has passed away, and she asks you if there's anything else you want out of the house. And what did you tell her?
Well, we had banged our heads together. She called me. I was seeing a patient at the time when I got okay. The call that the Black Forest was on fire. She was bringing my dog Obi back from the vet and had to go around a police blockade because they said there's a fire threatening this area. So you'll have to not go up there. She went a different way because we had animals in the house to rescue, as you pointed out. From the driveway, she called me. She gathered all the animals, you know, but we had talked on the phone. And it's funny because a year before that was the devastating Waldo Canyon fire, which cost about 300 and some odd houses. And you would think we'd have a list of the things we would grab in the event of, you know, an evacuation. You never think it's going to be the real deal. We didn't. But we didn't have a list. And so we banged our heads together. We said, well, let's grab both computers. Don't worry about the monitors. And just a few other things. I thought, grab my watch. I don't know why I said my watch. I did not say anything about my Bible, which I'd written in extensively since becoming a Christian in 1980. And yet she remembered to grab that. She comes back. She comes out. She's got all the animals. She said, okay, I've got to get out of here. Because I don't know where the fire is right now. And she said, anything else? And I was leaving on an airplane the next day to go to my dad's funeral. I said, I'm going to need my toiletry kit. So would you go back in and grab that? And she said, are you kidding me, John? Really? And I said, no, get out of there. You know, a spark of sanity hit me. And I said, get out of there. You know, we were able to purchase what I would need for that. But she had one little basket of laundry clothes, and that was about it.
Well, you know, I think that story, I know it's a little strange, but I think there's something to it that sometimes we can get focused on the wrong thing. And I really relate to that because I would have been trying to juggle everything in my mind that was going on. And one of them is, oh, gosh, I get on a plane and I need the toiletries. without really maybe thinking it all the way through. And I think we do this all the time. And that's one of the things that, Jesus was trying to do, is refocus us from all the worry about the minutiae, and are we going to be cared for, and what are we going to eat, what are we going to wear, and that kind of thing. I mean, you literally had to go through something like that, and Jesus is saying, you know, focus on the spiritual. So in the middle of all this, God gave you seven words that start with the letters PR. And could you please share those seven words and how, in the moment of receiving them, how did God focus you on the spiritual rather than on the material?
Well, it wasn't too hard when you think about it. We had no material. it really happened in my dad's study at his home. I was there planning to go to a funeral the next day. And I just grabbed a piece of paper and a pen, and I started writing it. And I'm quite confident that it was God who gave me seven words that start with the letters PR. And, you know, to me, that's very intellectually satisfying to see something like that. but the words were process. I wrote them in the order he gave them to me: pray, prepare, provide, protect, prevail, and prosper. It didn't necessarily happen one and then it stopped and then the next. I mean, I've seen pieces of each of these, but generally we started at processing. And this kind of processing, I mean, I'm not trying to compare my loss with anyone else's. All loss is difficult, but this was a lot of stuff to digest in one day, this kind of loss. And I was numb, basically. And so processing, I think, equates pretty much to a grieving process. You know, you just don't know how to wrap your head around what has happened in your life. Right. You don't, you know, and that's when it's very easy to rely on God, say, God, I can't do this. I need you, and I need you now. Okay. And we did a lot of praying throughout the process because we didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, I even contemplated giving up my optometry career because I was just wondering if God was, I never thought he punished me or anything like that. I never had those thoughts. But I just was wondering if he was steering me in another direction. And Nancy said something very wise to me. That's my wife. She said, why would you give up the one semblance of normalcy in our lives? We've lost so much of our normalcy. What you love your patients. They love you. You love doing what you do. Why wouldn't you keep that? And I'm glad I did, because in California, I got a call from a doctor named Rhonda Grigg. Rhonda and her husband, Peter, who's also a MD, have invited me to be with them on, it's been now six or seven medical missions trips to other countries. The first one was me and Peter going to Uzbekistan. And then one or the other, or both of them, and I went to El Salvador, where we were ministering knee, eyes, kind of things, optical things, glasses and things, and them medical to people who are very, very poor. I mean, these people live on the average a dollar a day. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have anything but dirt floors in their homes. And it was just a joy to be able to help them become entrepreneurs. The whole ministry that's based in El Salvador there is intended to help these people become entrepreneurs and develop businesses and things. And I think it's been largely successful. So preparing, we did a lot of preparation, a lot of talking, providing. We ultimately did need to provide for our needs, and God delivered. I thought, I can't even tell you exactly how it happened, but you know, we were so blessed by so many people who came around us and loved on us and asked if they could help us in some way. And then obviously protecting what you're just putting in place, because it's a fragile framework at first, you know, providing housing for yourself and things like that. And then ultimately we really saw that we were not just existing, but we were prevailing and indeed prospering. So I wouldn't compare myself to Job in any way, but I kind of got a feel for what Job felt like. Okay, Job was a righteous man. I didn't feel like I'm a righteous man. I'm not sure Job did either, but he was by God's own description. And I felt that God was so faithful to both of us throughout this entire ordeal. It was magnificent to watch him work. And I can tell you, he gave me a peace that passes understanding. You know, there's nothing like having everything you could possibly want one day and having nothing the next. And yet he gave me a peace and just a recognition that he's all I really need. You know, we say that, you know, we say that, you know, I don't need the stuff that I have. And I think if you're honest, and I know you are, Cecil, we have more stuff than we need. We just do. It accumulates, you know. Yeah. One of the things Nancy said after the fire is, because we were worried, we were both retired Air Force officers. We had taught at the academy. We had collected lots of stuff, boxes and boxes that had never been opened, but traveled from one Air Force station to another. And we were becoming anxious about what are our kids going to do with all this stuff if we die, yeah. you know, before yeah. we've done anything with this. And after the fire, Nancy said something, it's in the book. She said, well, at least a fire is an amazing decluttering tool.
not what it's recommended, but it is. We're talking with John Ravens, the author of Defined by Fire, Seven Life-Changing Lessons from Devastating Tragedy. And, you know, there's this parable that I talked about in the first half of the podcast, the parable of the rich fool in his barns and building up and looking for comfort and that sort of thing. And I was wondering, does that parable have new meaning to you now, having gone through this experience?
I hope so. I can see how people can get so wrapped up in their things mm-hmm. that they lose sight of who is ultimately the giver of those things. You know, and I was certainly in that camp. You know, I was building quite a nice nest egg and, you know, just real happy with where I was financially. But this was a great reminder of, you know, where our priorities need to lie. The very first chapter of the book, the seven chapters cover just incredible, to me, life lessons. The first chapter is, I'm not defined by what I own. I'm defined by him who owns me.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. And, you know, we would all agree, if you asked, if somebody asked us, we would agree that we can't take it with us.
Right.
But we don't really believe that because deep down, we don't believe we're going to die. Okay. And this becomes the essence of our lives, what we have here and what we own here. I mean, you can't tell me that you haven't met people who are more than enamored with their sports car or their sports team or their career or title or even their spouse or their children. Okay. And you can discern that by taking it away from them. You know, I mean, I lost everything all in one day. So it was just a huge blow. And that's when God stepped in and really comforted us. We received a lot of comfort. But I can see, you know, if somebody were to steal something from me, you know, I could get very angry and wonder, why are they doing that to me? You know, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. It's not necessarily. But it turns out that God brought a lot of good out of this tragedy simply because of what he's been teaching me. I have a sub-chapter in this first chapter, and it's called, believe it or not, Don't Die with New T-shirts. Okay, Cecil, I have what I think is a form of mental illness. I say this tongue-in-cheek, which has to do with the love of new things. I love new things. Now, everyone would say I love new things, but I think I love them to an unhealthy point. Okay. I used to collect T-shirts. I was in the Air Force for 25 years, and I collected T-shirts from all over the world. I collected animal prints. I collected Hard Rock Cafe shirts from all sorts of different countries. I collected college shirts, you name it. I collected them. And being an anal sort of military officer type, I would fold them neatly in little squares, and I'd put them neatly in drawers and on shelves. I had, and I'm not exaggerating, probably over 200 new T-shirts that I never wore. And I would open drawers periodically and I would say, oh, wow, that's a beautiful lion shirt. I need to wear that sometime. Bottom line, fast forward to a fire, I never wore any. I wore my old comfortable shirts and I lost hundreds of shirts in a fire. And God, he doesn't speak to me very often in an audible voice. And this wasn't an audible voice, but I knew it was him. He said, John, this is a great lesson for you. If I gift you, whether it be with a tangible gift like a T-shirt or a spiritual gift, you're to use it. That's why you have it, why you have breath in your lungs, and I want you to use it or you risk losing it. So that was a great, great lesson for me. And as hard as it's been, I have received a lot of new t-shirts and I'm trying to wear them all. And they're actually growing on me. They're okay. You know, they don't become less than valuable just because I've used them. You know?
Well, yeah, John, that's a great lesson. I can see you can use that in a lot of teaching right there. That's a great lesson for us all to remember, because you know you can't take it with you, and you need to appreciate the things you have and actually use the things you have. And it's stewardship. It's stewardship there also.
We're in the process now again of decluttering because we've accumulated a lot of things, and so we're donating things. We want to downsize some. It seems like a constant battle for us. Yeah, I don't want another fire to do it. I don't need that.
So let me ask you, if what advice would you give our listeners about focusing on the spiritual rather than the material in their seven-day practical faith journeys?
Well, it took a fire to help me learn how to focus on that, okay, because I wasn't good at doing it. I'm the kind of person that puts a list together every week, and it's all the things that I want to see accomplished, okay? And I sort of become my own little god. Like, I'll be blessed if I'm able to do this. It's almost like me getting before the Lord and saying, Lord, I need you to help me do this. And I am learning to spend more time unfettered before the Lord in the mornings. And not have an agenda. Too often, you know, we want to ask God for things. And I have become convinced that if I get before the Lord in the morning and say, God, what can I do for you today? That sounds really like a pious, good prayer, doesn't it? What can I do for you today? It's not. It's not. Now, really, this is coming from me, but my feeling is that disappoints God. I think he would look at us and say, are you kidding me? What do you mean? What can you do for me today? All you can do is be my kid and just walk in the knowledge of my grace and know that I love you and I will lead you. What did Jesus say to his disciples more than any other direction? You know, they said, what are we going to do today? What are we going to do today? And he always said, what? Follow me. Just follow me, because I am not going to lead you astray. All right. It may be tough, but if you've got me in your life, you're good. And that has meant a lot to me. So I'm sitting before the Lord more these days, not enough, but more than I used to, and just waiting on him to speak to me. Sometimes I'm so busy talking to him that I don't have ears to hear him. And I need to make time for that, because what he says to me is far more important than what I would say to him. That's my feeling. And so I'm learning to do that. I used to go to church with a guy, his name was Dan. And never understood him at the time. I was a baby Christian at the time, but he was a very successful businessman. And he said once in church, he says, you know, he says, I don't say this to brag, but he says, I spend 2.5 hours a day in prayer and devotions. He says, because I feel like I'm called not to just tithe my money, but my time. So 2.5 hours a day is about 10% of a day. And I said to him, Dan, I that's commendable, but how do you get everything done? He said, John, God's logic is different from ours. He says, I don't know how I get everything done, but I do know this. If I don't spend that time in prayer, I will never get everything done. I thought that was profound. I've never forgotten that.
That reminds me of, and I don't remember who it was, but it was some sort of, you know, one of our saints, I guess, who said, I have such a busy day today, I'm going to have to spend an extra lot of time in prayer because of all that's ahead of me. You know, the natural inclination is to say, I don't have time to pray because I'm too busy. And he said, I need to double up on my prayer because I'm so busy. Right.
We don't have time not to pray.
Yeah.
So he got it. And so I'm learning to do those things. And I'm also learning that I don't have to get everything done. You know, people have asked me, how do you like retirement? I sold my optometry practice a little over a year ago, and I don't feel retired because I'm doing much more writing now, as you and I talked before this podcast, but I'm doing much more writing. I'm doing it in a solitary place with just me and God. I love it. It is so meaningful to me. I don't get distracted because I have nothing to distract me up in the mountains with, no phones, no internet, nothing. It's just me and God. And I find that when all you have to do is spend time with God and maybe write some, you do that. And so that's what I'm doing.
Well, I have to tell you, the advice you're giving here, I don't know how many of the listeners are going to relate to it, but you got one here who's relating to it. And I want to apply those things in my life better, as you've said. And to wrap this up, could you share with our listeners how to find your book and how they can follow you?
Well, the book is available on Amazon under Defined by Fire, John Raven's Defined by Fire. It's also available on my website, which is definedbyfire.com, all one word, definedbyfire.com. It can be purchased there at a little bit of a discount.
Good.
For those interested. And we even offer, it's been used in multiple Bible studies across the state of Colorado, and because there are some very difficult questions at the end of each chapter, which are challenging. And just to give you an idea, I was asked to facilitate through my book at a fairly large men's Bible study at my church. There were over 30 guys there on most days. And these questions are so challenging. And the fear I had was that men do not open up with other men. They just don't. And that's probably been your experience as well. Mm-hmm. But they did. They would take the mic and tears would come down their eyes because something touched a nerve. So I know these questions are valuable. And again, it's been used several times. I'm pleased.
That's great. So it's definedbyfire.com.
That is my website. Yes.
John, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. It was great to be here. And blessings to you, my friend.
John mentioned the seven life-changing lessons, which are different from the seven PR words. The lessons are all formatted like this. I'm not defined by dot, dot, dot. Rather, I'm defined by dot, dot, dot. In other words, John learned and shared what he is not defined by and what he is defined by. For example, I'm not defined by what I own. Rather, I'm defined by who owns me. That's, I believe, the first lesson that he has. I should add that sifting through the questions in John's book at the end of each chapter, they are really good questions for either an individual or a group to consider. These are the types of questions I try to write for group discussions in my material, so I really appreciate the great job John has done in assembling these thought-provoking questions. I want to close with a final thought I saw recently from a writer named Jim Rigby. It relates to what we've been talking about today. Rigby wrote, "If we believe we are rewarded materially for our spiritual prayers and sacrifices, then we run the risk of believing material blessings are the greater good." Let me read that again. If we believe we are rewarded materially for our spiritual prayers and sacrifices, then we run the risk of believing material blessings are the greater good. I am so encouraged by some blessings that I've received lately in terms of my ministry, but if I fool myself into thinking those are the end goal, then I will start chasing blessings. That's not what we're supposed to do. Take those blessings as evidence of something greater going on spiritually, how God is moving in my ministry, of how God is moving in your life. Spend more time thinking about the source of those blessings rather than the blessings themselves. I believe that's one way to focus on the spiritual rather than the material. Speaking of those blessings, I'm so encouraged by the recent response to my two books and video studies, The Next Thing on Faith-Based Crisis Management and Live Like You're Loved, on how we can turn our head knowledge of God into a transformed life that fulfills His vision for us. You can find these materials at CecilTaylorMinistries.com, and the books themselves are also available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, many other online booksellers. Let me share one review that just came in on Amazon shortly before I recorded this podcast from someone identified as Chevy17. And the timing of it simply propelled me to focus harder as I organized my thoughts for this podcast. Chevy17 wrote this about Live Like You're Loved. I've been a Christian since I was young. I knew the mentioned verses and references by the author and still grasp new applicable insight through his words. I believe the author is right on point about the difficulty of translating church and God into a daily, 7 days a week lifestyle. It is definitely a disconnect between the head and the heart. The book identifies how and why this happens and how to correct it in us. He uses the SAIL method to lead you through the steps of transformation with some stories of the past, people, and his own life experiences. I would love to read his other books and go through the accompanying video series. Whoever you are, you need this book. Wow, it just shows me how much God is working behind the scenes with people I will probably never meet, multiplying my efforts in order to achieve his purpose. So I encourage you to follow Chevy 17's advice and understand that you need this book and video study too. As always, I would ask that you follow Cecil Taylor Ministries on Facebook and or become a subscriber to my free newsletter by visiting my website, ceciltaylorministries.com, and registering either in the orange box or via the pop-up devotional offer. Next month, we have a very different topic to discuss. The number 7 theme of Jesus by volume is his speaking about or indicating the execution of a miracle. After we study a sampling of the miracles themselves, I'll be joined by Reverend Amy Bauman, founder of For His Glory Ministry, a very popular Facebook ministry with global reach. Amy is the only person I've met who has experienced a verifiable miracle in her life. So she'll talk about that miracle and more during our time together. Until next time, please follow along with what I'm doing at ceciltaylorministries.com, the Cecil Taylor Ministries Facebook page, on LinkedIn, look up Cecil Taylor, and also on YouTube, on the Cecil Taylor Ministries YouTube channel. Let's reflect our priority on the spiritual through living a 7-day practical faith.